If you're gay, then you're gay. Don't pretend that you're straight. You could be who you are any day of the week. You are unlike the others, so strong and unique. We're all with you.
If you're straight, well, that's great. You can help procreate and make gay little babies for the whole human race. Make a world we can live in where the one who you love's not an issue. Cause we're all somewhere in the middle. We're all just looking for love to change the world. And we're all here in it together. We're one step closer to breaking down the walls.
Thanks for tuning in, and welcome to the August 24th, 2020 edition of IMRU Radio Magazine, the world's longest-running lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender radio show, out front and out loud since 1974. I'm Michael Taylor Gray. Tonight, we take a look at two movies available online about a gay power couple in Hollywood's golden age, Don Bacardi and Christopher Esherwood. And finally, we get the 411 on his sordid career from playwright Del Shores. The Chicano Moratorium is August 29th, and September 15th to October 15th is National Hispanic American Heritage Month. So what better reason to start off this week's show with an encore Gaytino report?
Bienvenidos. Welcome to the Gaytino Report, voices from the Latino LGBTQ community. I'm Dan Guerrero, or if you can roll your R's, Guerrero. And welcome to my guest, Oscar Quintero, a.k.a. the fabulous Quesadilla, the glittering star of L.A.'s wildly popular Chicos Angels, a Latina drag version of you-know-what 1970s TV show. This Spanglish comedy romp is in its 14th year at the Cavern Club Theater in Silver Lake. But there's much more to Oscar than Quesadilla, although she would strongly disagree. Welcome, Oscar.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm so excited. I've seen the show a couple of times, and I am one of your many fans.
Oh, very nice.
I want to just say, drag can be kind of a loaded word, you know, but you consider yourself not a drag queen or a drag performer or female impersonator, but simply a character actor.
An actor, yeah. If somebody calls me drag queen, I'm not like, I'm not a drag queen. Because for lack of a better term, that's what I do. I perform in drag. I don't look at it as a bad word, but I think most people, when they think of a drag queen, they think clubs, lip syncing, and I don't do that because I'm not very good at that. So I kind of found another niche for myself within the drag world. It's just a different style. And I've auditioned for RuPaul's Drag Race 3 times, and I haven't gotten on the show. And that one of the things I've always mentioned on my application is, like, I don't lip sync because I'm terrible at it. And I wonder if that's part of the reason I haven't gotten on. Because the few times that I've done it, I felt more exposed than when I was actually singing. I felt just naked. And I was like, I don't like this. It didn't feel good.
I didn't realize that everybody has to lip sync on that show.
Well, it's part of the curriculum at the end. If you're one of the final two, you have to lip sync for your life.
Well, then you better learn, sister.
Right?
Get with it.
Well, I just figured it wasn't for me.
Would it be fair to call Quesadilla your alter ego, which is, you know, a clone, your second self? Are you alike? Are you completely different?
Sure. I mean, you know what? It's funny because I feel like Kay's a version of myself that I wish I had the confidence to be. So yeah, you could say she's my alter ego. She's a version of myself that is fearless in some ways. Some would say clueless. There's a very fine line because when I was single, I was a lot braver to go up to people and just flirt. I guess because I knew it was safe. There would be no repercussions. Yeah. It's funny, though. I got to say, there was a part of me that was kind of quiet and a bit of a wallflower. But I feel like somehow the years of doing Quesadilla, I met in the middle. The way I would describe myself when I was younger, it's like I would apologize before I even walked in the room. You know what I mean? I was just so scared of everyone and people and just basic conversation scared me.
You come from a family of 6, right?
I'm the youngest of 6.
And Hacienda Heights.
Yeah.
Which I've heard of.
Hacienda Heights! Me and Fergie.
You learned early that you had to speak up in order to be noticed in that group of 6. So how does that jive with what you just said?
Well, my mother was this loud, drunk, for lack of a better term. She was the life of the party. And our world revolved around my mother. My brothers and sisters all tried to find their voice within her world. And it was alcohol parties every weekend. And it just became louder and louder and violent. So, yeah, in order for me to stand out or to even be noticed in that house, I had to get louder. And most of the times I would be performing to Grease soundtrack in the living room for my family and that kind of stuff.
Was Kay Sevilla screaming to come out that early?
I guess she was, in one way or another. But I remember when I was a kid, I put this belt that my mother had that was all fringe. And I just remember kind of wiggling my hips and loved the way it felt. And then I put my mom's heels on and I was just playing in her room. And I was probably like 4 or 5. My father walked in, flipped out, and cool. I think I got the belt that night or something. You know, so then I knew there's something wrong with this. I'm not supposed to do this. And it was very innocent. Like, I didn't think twice of it when I was doing it. And then there was a couple years that I dressed in drag and I kind of realized that was pretty, so that helped. And it just went from there. And I was just like, wow, this is fun. It was a freedom. But you know, the way I describe my drag is I'm a clown. I'm purely a clown. That's why the makeup is exaggerated. And it's over the top. And it's garage clown makeup is what I call it.
I love that,
Jim. Yeah.
Kay Sevilla has spawned quite a cottage industry for Oscar, mm-hmm. right? I mean, there's other shows, Love Boat Chicas, Chicas in Chains, and a Tupperware Fiesta Empire, literally. Why don't we talk to Kay Sevilla about how she made Oscar Quintero a star?
You want to call her in?
Yeah.
Hey, Kay, come here.
What happened? Hey, Bang. Hey, how are you?
Well, how are you?
I'm okay. Just sitting here being sexy, but I can't help it, Bang. It just happens.
You either got it or you ain't.
Thank you.
And you got it.
Thank you. Obviously, thank you for noticing.
Hard not to. Pero let me ask you a question. I went to your website, which, by the way, looks like a piñata exploded.
Thank you. That's my life.
In a good way. But if I may, I want to tell our listeners some of the pages that you can click on.
Okay.
There's Please Underdressing Me With Your Eyes.
Yes.
There's Jew Don't Know My Life.
Yes.
And your videos, America's Next Top Chica Model.
Uh-huh.
And a YouTube cooking show, or as you call it, YouTube.
YouTube. Yes.
YouTube. Tell me about, tell me whatever you want. How did you and Oscar meet?
Well, you know how we met? I did a pageant because, you know, I'm a beauty queen.
Very beauty.
Thank you. And I competed for the Quest for the Crown, which was like a Miss Universe pageant back in 2000 when I was, you know, 5 years old. Anyway, but it was my first time ever doing a big production like that. It was at the Wiltern Theater in Los Angeles, celebrity judges. And I was so in awe. First off, I was just happy that they let me in the building. And the fact that I ended up doing so well, I became the crowd favorite. I was the first runner-up. I should have won, but whatevers. You know, they didn't have a donkey on stage. I did. That's all I'm saying. I should have won. And it literally just changed the course of my life that night, because I ended up performing a drag strip that following week. I ended up doing a short film. And then before you know it, I had a full-on career.
And there's something you don't know about that night.
What is it?
I was there.
You were there?
I was there.
Wasn't I the favorite?
No, you were.
Oh, come on.
No, listen. Jimmy Cuomo, who does the sets for it every year, is a very good friend. And so I was there, and I thought you were fabulous. And I wanted you to win not only because you were fabulous, mm-hmm. but because you were Latina.
Of course.
I was like, I want that. And yeah, you came awfully close.
I remember that night feeling like, oh my gosh, I was so convinced I was going to be in last place. And then when I was the final two, me and Miss France, I was like, is this really happening right now? It was a very exciting night. But it's funny, full circle, they haven't officially announced it. So I guess this is the official announcement. Patrick Rush, who has hosted the event every year, has decided that last year was his last year. They asked me to take over as host. Can you believe it?
Oh, my gosh.
A little booty queen from Tijuana is the host of the new
that
Best in Drag show.
That is fantastic. Yes. And we got the scoop right here on
you
the Gaytino Report. Mm-hmm. This is Dan Guerrero with the Gaytino Report. And I'm talking to actor Oscar Quintero, a.k.a. Kay Sevilla of Chicos Angels. You have a real rags-to-riches story because you were born in Tijuana, mm-hmm. as you say, mm-hmm. the youngest of 18 children.
18 shearings.
And according to Jew, the prettiest.
I can't help it. That's what I always tell people. Don't hate me because I'm beautiful. Trust me, after a few minutes, you'll find many other reasons to hate me.
You won the Miss Tijuana Natural Springs Water Contest.
The water that spring right through you.
But I want to hear about a torrid love affair that you had with a hunky immigration officer.
Oh, it was so nice. It was the way I got here the first time. You know, I'm not afraid to sleep my way to the middle. I'm not. We slept in the same bed. That's all we did. But it was nice. It was a good time. And it helped me get across the border for the first time. But it also inspired, can I tell you my movie pitch that I want to do?
Sure.
It's called Tijuana a Go-Go. It's about a go-go dancer who falls in love with the immigration officer. They have a love affair, and she keeps trying to cross the border. One day, he just lets her pass by. And it's all done to like 60s music. Almost like Sweet Charity meets Tijuana Hookers.
Another scoop for the Gaytino Report. I'm on a roll here. Pero you know what, mija? I see Oscar's looking a little miffed over there in the corner.
Don't even look at him.
No, but
that's his resting bitch face.
But you don't want to upset him because he is your ride home.
I guess so.
Right? So let's bring Oscar back.
Okay, Dan. Thank you so much for having me, Dan. Hey, Oscar, come back. They want to talk to you. I don't know why.
Hi.
Hi. Wow. Schizophrenia
right in front of me. A little bit.
You talked a little bit about your family earlier. First of all, I want to back up on that because you said how, of course, your dad was shocked and smacked you. And that's, I'm sure, very common because, as you said, it was totally innocent. You weren't saying, I want to be a girl.
Yeah.
You weren't saying, I'm gay. You just were playing, you know? And that squishes a lot of kids that early who are doing something innocent that society maybe looks at differently, and you lose time because then you got to rebuild later in life.
But you know what? I don't hate my father for it because I knew he's a product of his time.
Of course.
And we were all taught that's wrong. Boys do A, B, and C. Girls do D, C, and F. And we're all conditioned to believe that this is the way we're supposed to be. And my father fell right into that. And I think he had a fourth or fifth grade education. He came here on top of a train when he was a kid to work in the field, to send money back to his nine brothers and sisters. So I don't fault him for it. It was a product of his environment. And the funny thing is, my father became my biggest fan when I started doing Quesadilla, you know, before he passed. And he came to all my shows. He was front and center. And there's a bunch of pictures of us. And then I remember one time I brought him up on stage when I was doing the curtain call, and audience went just ballistic for him. So he loved it. And I remember coming home to my sister's. I had just done a Tupper party. I was walking in to her house, and my nephew, who was like 6 years old at the time, he was just nonchalantly passed by and said, hi, Quesadilla. And my dad started busting up. It became so normal in our family for me to walk in drag now. It was...
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. Yeah. And you're right. You know, listen, parents do the best they can. They goofed us all up, as their parents did.
Yeah.
They didn't do it on purpose. You do the best you know with the tools you have at that time, and there you go.
You know, and I'm a parent now, and I'm sure I'm going to screw my kid up in different ways.
Oh, I have no doubt.
Yes.
But let me ask you this. 1 year old baby, are you insane?
You know, it's funny. I've always wanted a family of my own. And then my husband, when I first brought it up to him, he was like, no, I don't want children. Again, we're conditioned to think that's not for us as gay men. But we were able to have a legal wedding, and it was a celebration of love. We had 150 guests, including our families. And after about a year of me trying to convince him, he was like, I guess that's the next progression in a relationship, is that you create a family. And I'll tell you, it was such a challenging process. And the whole year has been challenging, but I would not change a thing. Like, sometimes I just look at him, or I'm like, I'm in the living room dancing with him when we're watching one of his cartoons or something. And I just start like getting choked up. I'm like, can't believe he's mine. You know, I get to raise this little nugget. And it's, I wish more in the LGBT community could experience this, because we're told this isn't for you. You don't get to do this. And I'm like, no. Somebody else made those rules, and I'm going to break those rules as much as I can, because this is such a wonderful experience. And it's not for everyone. The first probably five of my closest gay friends, when I first told them, hey, we're gonna have a baby, they're like, and I'm not kidding, all five of them like, why would you want to?
But there are straight couples that don't have kids.
Exactly. And
nobody says you have to have kids, gay or straight.
But I think that reaction was so conditioned to the way we thought about ourselves.
Maybe.
That, like, no, that we don't do that. What are you doing? You're going against the grain. Gay and lesbians don't do that. I'm like, I've always wanted a family. And sure enough, I still want one more child, even though this was literally the most challenging year for my husband and I, but I still want another child. But it's not easy, especially when you're older, and the lack of sleep can really kind of break you at certain points. But
well, I grew up in 1950s East LA as a gay boy.
Oh, wow.
And you could have said you were going to land on the moon sooner than have children or get married. It was not, I don't know, sometimes I think the younger people, young gay boys especially, and gay women think that we were always like, oh, someday I'm going to have a kid. Someday we're going to marry. You couldn't conceive of it. And so I, in particular, find it to hear beautiful stories like that. And by the time that it was possible to have children, it was too late for me.
I hear that. But the funny thing is, one of the biggest arguments my husband and I had when we were planning this, because, you know, we're of a certain age as well.
Oh, you're a baby,
I'm in my mid-40s. My husband's about to turn 50, but was our age. And I kept saying, you know what? Again, these are somebody else's rules of when you are supposed to have children. However, I would say I get why younger people have kids because they can deal with the lack of
sleep. That's right.
Yeah, but you know what? It's never too late. I know everybody's older. I know it becomes harder. At least foster.
All right, I'll get a child.
Thank
never
you.
Mind that I'm 77.
That's
I'm
all.
77.
Is that
I should have asked Kay, and I didn't, but I'll ask you because she might have mentioned it to you.
Yeah.
The Tupperware parties sound wild. Oh, my gosh. And it's a big part of your career.
It's probably 85% of my income. I fell into it. I went to a Tupperware party that a friend of mine had, and it was Frank, the old folk singer. She calls herself the all-American Jewish folk singing, surfing, lesbian Tupperware lady. And she looked like a milkman. She had a flat top. She would sing these little cute songs with the guitar at the Tupperware party. And I just sat there thinking, I could totally do this as quesadilla. I signed up with no expectations. I literally did it for the hell of it. And then within a couple years, I started making six figures. Most money I'd ever made in my job. I quit my full-time grocery worker job that I had for 13 years that I hated, and I started doing this full-time. But then it also just led me down other creative avenues, and I cannot imagine going back to like a 9-to-5 again. I've opened Pandora's box, the whole creative aspect of putting a show together, of writing, of creating concepts and ideas, or this person says that. I mean, it fills my heart like nothing else ever has. The whole process does, not just the performing. It's all within the same family. The Tupperware kind of gave me an audience night after night where I started learning how to command a room, how to command a stage, and how to keep an audience engaged. A lot of my jokes would bomb. For me, the bigger joke is recovering from a bomb. That all became schooling for me, is audience night after night after night. And very intimate. There'd be like 20, 30 people in the room, or sometimes there'd be 10 people in the room, and I'm performing a full-on comedy musical show in their living room. I felt naked some days, and then some days I was like, I got this. You know what I mean?
It's a show. It's the same as if you're on stage and there's 1,000 people out there. It's
exactly.
A show, whether there's 3 people, and I've known shows with 3 people,
or, so have we.
Yeah. or 1,500, and I've done those too. It's all the same. You do a show. I want to thank you so much, Oscar, for being here. And Kay, I want to thank you too.
You got it.
And I'll see you both at the Cavern Club.
Thank you, Dan, so much. Thank you so much. And thank you for giving us this platform, too. It's great to have the gaytinos out in the world.
Oot and a boot.
Oh, yeah.
Oot and a boot. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is Dan Guerrero with the Gaytino Report, and I've been talking with actor Oscar Quintero, a.k.a. Quesadilla of Chicos Angels. Until next time, ten orgullo. Be proud.
Reminder, the Chicano Moratorium is August 29th, and National Hispanic American Heritage Month runs September 15th to October 15th, and Dan Guerrero's autobiographical one-man show, Gaytino, will be available to purchase for viewing at noon on August 25th at Outfest LA 2020. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Nell Carter, pop soul belter, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Known for her dynamic performances on stage, television, film, and record, Nell Carter built a successful show business career despite a number of personal tragedies. She was born Nell Ruth Hardy in Birmingham, Alabama in 1948. When she was a small child, her father died suddenly after stepping on a live power line. At 15, she was raped at gunpoint. Comforting herself with music, Nell performed in church choirs, youth groups, and on local radio. But it was in the late 1960s that she pursued her calling to the stage. She moved to New York, changed her name to Carter, studied acting, and began singing at nightclubs. Nell Carter's big success came in 1978 with her run in the musical Ain't Misbehavin'. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Joanne Colbert Gunn.
Hi, I'm Amanda Burse, and you're listening to IMRU Radio Magazine, out front and out loud since 1974.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Taylor Gray, and you're listening to IMRU Radio. In these shut-in times, streaming queer films online can keep you from hitting on the mail carrier. And tonight, we celebrate two films inspired by last week's guests, the first of which is A Single Man.
Based on the novel by Christopher Isherwood and set in 1962 Los Angeles, A Single Man depicts a day in the life of George Falconer, a British college professor, played by Colin Firth, who's struggling to find meaning in his life after the death of his longtime partner. Edmund White called Isherwood's book one of the first and best novels of the post-gay liberation movement, and a fashion designer Tom Ford's screenwriting and directorial debut, Tales of the City author and my friend Armistead Maupin, told me he's still reeling from the film's beauty and uncompromising message, as am I.
You haven't slept with her, have you?
Yes.
And?
A few times when we were younger. I wouldn't say it meant nothing to me, but it certainly meant a great deal more to Charlie. It was a long time ago in London. I love Charlie. And we're very close friends, but that's all.
Well, I'm confused. I mean, if you sleep with women, then why are you with me?
Because I fall in love with men.
Because I fell in love with you.
This is Tom Ford. Christopher Isherwood was way ahead of his time. One of the things I always loved about his writing was the matter-of-fact way that he treated homosexuality. You know, most of his stories and novels were autobiographical, and so there is usually a gay character, but that's not the center of the story. The gay character is portrayed as a human being who lives a life. And the relationship between George and Jim, I felt it was very important to depict that in a very matter-of-fact way. Really, two people who are in love with each other. And I wanted this not to be a gay story or a straight story, but to be a human story. And I think that the more that we see that and realize that love between two people is love between two people, the better off we'll all be for that.
As open as George is about his sexuality, in 1962, acceptance was another story.
You only sense it a couple of times when he's not invited to the funeral because he's not family. And the biggest time, really, when Julianne, or Charlie, his very best friend who's known him for years, says to him, you know, don't you miss this, what we could have been, having a real relationship and kids. And that, to me, if I were George, would have been the thing that stung the most, that someone so close to you still didn't really understand the relationship that you had with someone else.
Tom, you have a long-term partner.
23 years.
Did that help you to relate to George's loss?
The idea of losing someone that you love could throw you into a situation where you could not see your future and you really would be living in the past, which is what's happening with George. As I understand from Don Bacardi, Christopher's partner, Christopher wrote this story when Don left him for about 8 months, moved to New York with somebody else, and Christopher imagined that Don had died and that he was alone and wrote this story.
Isherwood's partner of 35 years, Don Bacardi, has a tiny cameo and was a consultant on the film.
Oh, it was wonderful, and he contributed a lot because whenever I had a question about something, like, for example, I wrote Julianne's character in a much more glamorous way than she's depicted in the book, and I said, Don, do you think I've gone too far by doing this? He said, the funny thing is, she was based on Iris Tree, who was very stylish, and he pulled out all these pictures of Iris Tree, and he said, you know, Christopher didn't want her to know that she was the inspiration for this part, so he changed her physically, but this was who the real woman was, which of course made me feel better about altering that character to the extent that I did. So it was great to have Don, and it was great to have Don's vote of confidence. I mean, I think he genuinely loves the film and is very happy, so that makes me very happy.
As George Falconer, actor Colin Firth is in a way playing Christopher Isherwood.
I watched the very beautiful film about Chris and Don. I watched it twice. Christopher Isherwood and his partner Don Bacardi. There's a beautiful film called Chris and Don, a love story. I don't know if it helped me. It was of interest to me. I mean, whenever I embark on a project, it's sort of an opportunity to plunge into a particular world, a different perception, just learn maybe about a time or a place that I didn't know as much about. You know, love is love. I don't really feel that there's anything different to play because the partner happens to be male. The person I'll be playing opposite is unlikely to be my lover anyway. So these emotions, you know, you find them from somewhere. It's the job. So I think one of the things that I appreciate greatly about Isherwood's writing is that he doesn't make the sexuality a salient feature. I mean, sexual love is part of it. But he was writing at a time when there were a lot of writers covering that up. I mean, there's no question about it. You know, Terence Rattigan was writing relationships that were clearly about relationships between men, which he had to disguised as relationships between a man and a woman. Isherwood didn't feel the need to do that, but his characters just happen to be gay. I mean, they're not, you know, I don't really define myself by my sexuality either. And I think it's one of the things that George is not struggling with is his sexuality. He's struggling with a lot of things, but he's not struggling with being gay or not. He's fairly happy with who he is in that respect.
But Firth doesn't completely downplay the importance of George's homosexuality.
The sexuality is there because part of the love that he experiences is sexual. I mean, there's sex running all the way through the movie, which I think is strengthened by the fact that we don't need to see anybody humping, you know? No, it's great. I mean, it's we don't need to go into the territory of body functions. So you know, what's interesting about sex is its implications, it's the barriers that are broken down on the way to it. I mean, all these sorts of things are there in the film. The possibilities of it, the ambiguity, the fact that it's forbidden, the fact that I think George's homosexuality in 1960 might add to his isolation. The speech on fear to his students definitely is referencing that. I don't think it's dependent on it. Because the character's not taking this on as an issue, it's not his war with his sexuality or the war against prejudice, is not the salient feature of the film. But I think the fact that he is open and comfortably open about the fact that he is gay is definitely significant. I mean, otherwise, why bother to feature it at all? Tom said at a press conference recently that he doesn't define himself by his sexuality particularly. It's there. If you were asked to say 10 things to describe himself, he'd tell you he was from Texas, give you his name, tell you something about his life. Yeah, probably by the time he got to 10, he would have mentioned that he's a gay man. You know, I don't know if I would, in the top 10 things that tell you I was heterosexual, I don't know. It's not irrelevant. As I said before, I think it is about love. And I think it's, you know, it's about regret. It's about gaining or losing your love of life. What I like about it is it's absolutely unashamedly and unassumingly there. I think that if more of a feature were made of it, then it would seem as if it was struggling with something or had something to prove. I think this is homosexuality simply as sexuality like any other sexuality.
What could be better than being tucked up here with you? I mean, if I died right now, it'd be okay.
Well, it wouldn't be okay with me. Why don't you shut up and go and change the record?
Good answer.
Once again, the film's screenwriter and director, Tom Ford.
This movie is really about living in the moment, appreciating the small things in your life that sometimes just go by without you really observing, and understanding your connection to the universe, and understanding that relationships with other people are really the things that matter. And when George decides to take his own life, all of a sudden, the beauty of the world starts to pull at him because he's really looking and seeing for the first time. We have so many eyes in the film because George hasn't been looking people in the eyes. He's been blank. Now, all of a sudden, he's connecting, and people are responding to him in a different way. He's responding to them. This is a man whose inner world and outer world are connected and has a veneer, but just inside is this romantic guy who's suffering so much, and it's right behind the surface.
This has been a conversation with Tom Ford and Colin Firth. A Single Man also stars Julianne Moore, Nicholas Holt, Matthew Good, and is a Weinstein Company release. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
A Single Man is available to stream on Netflix. A documentary about Christopher Isherwood and his longtime life partner came out in 2008. It was called Chris and Dawn, A Love Story.
What good is sitting alone in your room? Come hear the music play. Life is a cabaret, old chum.
The film Cabaret was based on the adventures of Christopher Isherwood, as chronicled in his Berlin stories. So in the sequel, I suppose we'd learn our hero left Sally Bowles and Berlin for sunny Santa Monica, where he lived until his death in 1986 with portrait artist Don Bacardi.
My name is Tina Mascara, and I'm the co-director of Chris and Donna Love Story with my partner Guido Santi.
I'm here. Ready to.
What sort of feedback have you had from audiences so far?
So far, audiences really seem to love it, which really pleases us immensely because we put all of our heart and soul into it because we love Don Bacardi so much and we were so touched by his story with Christopher Isherwood, their love story.
What inspired this? What got you involved in this?
I first got involved because I was introduced to Don Bacardi through one of the producers of the film, Julia Scott. Her family befriended Don Bacardi and Christopher Isherwood for many years. And I just arrived in the States in 1990s. And eventually I met him, I became friend with Don. And one night he showed me this amazing 16mm footage that he shot with Christopher Isherwood as they were traveling around the world in the 50s. And I was so impressed and I was surprised that nobody ever asked him about the possibility of making a documentary on his life story because it's so extraordinary. Both Don and Christopher Isherwood were pioneers in being openly gay as a couple in the 50s, and they were 30 years apart. So they had a very interesting story.
You mentioned the age difference. How old were they when they got together?
Christopher was 48 years old and Don was 18. He looked much younger. He actually met Christopher Isherwood when he was 16 years old, but they didn't start their affair until 2 years later on Valentine's Day, 1953.
And certainly the trouble is that he looks so young. If you see pictures of Don Bacardi when he was in the 50s, he looks like 12. So a lot of people thought that Christopher Isherwood, the renowned British writer, was having an affair with a minor. And this was the scandalous aspect of it. But in reality, they were adults, both of them.
I would think it would be doubly difficult in the time period in which they were living and being so open.
I know that they were very discreet when they went out in public. Like in the movie, we talk about how they went to Monument Valley and they went to the set where John Ford was filming his movie. And I think probably most people assumed that they were father and son, and they didn't act contrary to that. They allowed people to believe that they were possibly father and son rather than flaunt their relationship in their faces.
I was stunned, though, when I finally heard Christopher Isherwood's voice. Talk a little about sort of the melding that happened.
I always like to repeat what Don says, is that he's an unconscious impersonator. I'm very familiar with Don now, so now I just think he sounds like Don. But I think the first time that I heard Christopher Isherwood speak, I was just floored how similar the speech patterns. He has this Oxford kind of British accent, his mannerisms, his the way he pauses, the way he chooses his words, everything is very much Isherwood. I think the way he wears his hair. Now I even know he wears Christopher Isherwood socks sometimes for good luck.
Yeah, red socks.
Chris was very famous for wearing red socks.
Red socks.
Sometimes you see it in photographs. And Don, sometimes I look down at an art show or something and I see those red socks. I have a private moment. I think, okay.
What do you want the audience to take away from the film?
This is a great love story, and it's a story of commitment. It's a story of watching two artists grow. It's the emergence of an artist. And I think what I want people to come away with is that it's a story of love, and love is powerful, whatever gender you are, you know? And I think that is really, really important, that whether you're heterosexual, homosexual, love is love, and that it's powerful, and that I want people to respect that and to really admire these two human beings.
Yeah, absolutely.
Writer, artist, activist, Don Bacardi.
Tell me about Christopher Isherwood. What was he like?
Oh, he's the most charming man I ever met. What was wonderful about him was his genuine curiosity about people. He wasn't faking it. When we met, he asked me all kinds of questions about myself. Until I met him, I'd never known anybody to take such an interest in me. And he was particularly interested in young people and young men in particular. And he wanted to know what their lives were like, what it was like to be them, what they were interested in. And you can always tell when somebody asks you questions, whether they're just making conversation, whether it's just idle curiosity, or whether it's the genuine article. And his was genuine.
What was the gay side of Hollywood like in the 50s?
Oh, there were clubs and bars, and of course they were very dangerous because they could be raided at any moment, and often were. And a certain bar would emerge and be very popular, and people would flock to it. But most of the bars lasted only a very short while because they were soon raided. And once they got a reputation for being raided regularly, they couldn't last. But while they did last, they were very exciting because it was dangerous, and everybody who was there knew that maybe that night the place would be raided and they might even be arrested. So that gave the experience a very decided edge.
You're quoted in a book on gay widowers by Eric Guitarez as saying that after the death of Isherwood, you transformed yourself and underwent a complete role reversal in the relationship that followed.
Yes, well, it was a very peculiar experience for me. First of all, reaching the age that Chris was when I first met him. Of course, he seemed so much older, and he was distinguished and from another generation, another country. And suddenly, I found myself the very age he was when I met him, and that was very significant. And he was still alive then. And then after his death, I found myself gradually being put into the position of being the older one of a couple. I met a young man, fell in love with him, who was 26 years younger than I was. And I suddenly found myself cast in Chris's role. And it was very illuminating for me because it gave me all sorts of insights into situations that I'd experienced with Chris. And I suddenly, for the first time, began to understand how he must have felt all those years before with me. And so it was a continual kind of communication with him because I was understanding aspects of his experience really for the first time. And also, his example was very helpful to me because often when I had problems with my friend, I would ask myself, how would Chris behave in this situation? And you know, I always got an answer. And it was often very, very helpful to me asking Chris's advice.
Dark and cold was the night you came. I told you to go, but you stayed anyway. You held your finger to my trembling lips. You said, come in close, kid. I won't let you slip. You said, hush, little babe, hush, little babe. It's your favorite song. Stop all this fussing, boy, there's nothing wrong. Swift like a bird we flew into the sun, into the blue. That's how I know I can love, I can love, I can love and be loved.
Chris and Don, A Love Story is screening on Amazon Prime. If you crave something fresher, LA's Outfest Film Festival runs August 20th through the 30th, virtually, at Outfest LA 2020. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Ain't Misbehaving with Nell Carter, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Carter exploded onto the Broadway stage in the 1978 musical Ain't Misbehaving, belting out scorching renditions of numbers like Honeysuckle Rose and Mean to Me. It also proved her an accomplished actress, winning a Tony Award for Best Featured Actress. 3 years later, she won an Emmy for the NBC television version of the show. Carter's next big success was her best-known role in NBC's Give Me a Break, where she played a housekeeper for a white family. In 2002, Carter was cast in the revival of the musical Raisin. But on January 23, 2003, 2 weeks before opening night, her son found her dead. The cause was apparently heart problems. It was only later that her longtime relationship with another woman, Ann Kaser, was revealed to the public. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Joanne Colbert-Gunn.
Hello, this is the actor Michael Emerson. It's not easy being one of the others. So if time travel or moving the island isn't an option and you're feeling sort of lost, try listening to IMRU.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Taylor Gray, and you're listening to IMRU Radio. Speaking of amazing writers, Del Shores is almost without peer. He's also an American film director and producer, television producer, and actor. Steve Pride sat down with the prolific playwright and TV writer to file this report.
Playwright and screenwriter Del Shores grew up in Texas, the son of a Southern Baptist preacher. His brother still lives in Texas and is a Southern Baptist preacher. Oscar Wilde once said, "To be understood is to be exposed." For Del Shores, that moment came in 1995 with the premiere of his fourth and most autobiographical play, a family dysfunction and gay coming out saga, Sordid Lives. Shores, then married for 9 years and with two daughters, burst from the closet personally and professionally in a big way.
It's not something that I ever really wanted to be because I was told that it was a horrible thing to be. So I didn't want to be that horrible thing. So I knew I was attracted to guys at a very early age, like early teen, but I just pushed it away and I never dealt with it until I was in my 30s. Already married with two children. Then I came out of the closet and, you know, the hinges of the door just sort of shattered. and I'm very proud and glad that I've dealt with it and happy, very happy now. We have such fears in our lives. And after I came out to my Southern Baptist preacher dad and my mom and the whole family, most fears went away because that was the scariest thing that I ever did. Because, I mean, you first of all, you face that fear of rejection, that you're not going to be a part of the family anymore. The one great thing about my mom, and when she passed away, I found all of these files where she had done so much research on my behalf about gay. She really wanted to be informed, and I wish that other people in my family would do that, because she wanted to know what it was about and asking way too many questions. So I'm, you know, the first time I go home is like Christmas. I bring my daughters, they're 2 and 5 at the time, and my mother comes into my bedroom and she says, "I need to ask you some questions." And I go, "Oh, okay." And she goes, "What is it exactly that you do?" And I'm like, "What?" And you know, she goes, you know, gay stuff. What do you do? And I'm like, "Oh my God, mother, I am not going to talk to you about this. There are books you can read." And then so finally she just kept on and I thought, okay, you know what? So I just basically looked at my lap and started explaining a lot of things. I left some things out. But, you know, that was the kind of mom she was. And then at the end of this conversation, she goes, "Well, the other day, your daddy and I were watching Sally, Jesse, Raphael." And she said, "Now, I don't mean to be ugly, but there were just a bunch of freaks on there. They were all kinds of people in transition. One was a man that used to be a woman. One was a woman. And then some of them had started hormone therapy." She said, "Now, you're not going down that road, are you?" I said, "No, Mom, I'm really happy being a gay man. I want to stay just like that." And then there's that long pause, which, of course, I put in the movie Sordid Lives. She goes, "Well, are you the woman or the man?"
Del Shore's plays include Cheatin', Daughters of the Lone Star State, Southern Baptist Sissies, The Trials and Tribulations of a Trailer Trash Housewife, Daddy's Dyin', Who's Got the Will, and Sordid Lives. The latter two were made into successful motion pictures, and the film version of Southern Baptist Sissies starts shooting in just a few months. But even if you've never seen one of his plays or films, you've still probably encountered his work as a writer on such TV shows as Queer as Folk, Dharma and Greg, Ned and Stacy, and even, oddly enough, Touched by an Angel.
I did one episode of Touched by an Angel. I did the Felicia Rashad alcoholic episode. And I got to tell you, I have made more residuals off of that one episode than probably I made doing one whole year of Ned and Stacy. It was a crazy thing. I wrote the fourth episode of the show. And they've novelized my episode. It's crazy. And so the next season, I actually was offered a job, and I chose Ned and Stacy over Touched by an Angel. And to this day, I think it was probably the biggest financial mistake of my career.
Del Shores is loved by most of the actors who've worked with him. Even his former in-laws remain close and regularly appear in his plays. But from his 3-year gig writing Queer as Folk, there is one actor of which he is not particularly fond. Randy Harrison, who played Justin.
Randy was so ungrateful for being on the show, and he was always turning down press, and basically, by the end of the show, nobody wanted him to do press because he would trash the show that pretty much made his career. I hope you're listening, Randy. It's not good for actors to do that because, you know what? People like myself won't ever hire you again. honestly, I adore actors, and most actors that have worked with me, and I, quite frankly, I mean, I'm not close to Randy and didn't know Randy that well because he was very distant from any of us. But I think it's appalling when an actor bites the hand that feeds them. And you can certainly use this. I have no qualms at all about it. And basically, at a point with the show, they had to call his people and say he is not allowed to do press anymore because he would literally trash the show and the character and the path of the show. So it was very unfortunate. So, you know. But the rest, I got to say, I mean, that cast was a dream cast.
In preparing for our interview, I read article after article that referred to openly gay writer Del Shores. So I asked Del about his default salutation.
Del Shores, openly gay writer-director, or openly gay writer-director Del Shores. And I'm really cool with being gay, and I love that I'm out, and it's okay if I'm the poster boy a little bit. But I don't really feel like that is all of the pie. You know, there's a lot more to me than just that. So sometimes it bothers me a little bit. And I got to tell you, our own community sometimes gets, like when I wrote The Trials and Tribulations of a Trailer Trash Housewife, I actually had people say, oh, well, you've betrayed us. There's nothing gay about this play. You know, I'd won the GLAAD Award for Southern Baptist Sissies, and the GLAAD committee called me and go, well, are you going to allot tickets for The Trials and Tribulations? I said, well, you know, it's not a gay play. And they were very upset at me. They felt like I had abandoned the community. But there are stories to tell that don't necessarily have to do with being gay. I mean, of course, Willa Dean had a gay son, and that was part of that. But I just write from, I'm a storyteller, first and foremost.
In Los Angeles, at the small 99-seat Zephyr Theater, squeezed between trendy shops on Melrose Boulevard, there's a repertory revival of all six Del Shores plays called A Season of Shores, featuring many of the original stars. Fans of his work are flying in from as far away as Germany, and the run is selling out almost as quickly as the next play is announced. For me, Southern Baptist Sissies hits hardest. It's the story of three boys growing up gay, in a church that condemns them, and in families that deny them.
I get more letters from gay men and gay women who have felt the torture and the pain, and they find this play very healing. And if that's all it does is heal some wounded hearts, then I'm really cool with that. But I got to tell you, when I was living in Sherman Oaks, across the street were some wonderful people who were Southern Baptist, and they came to see the play. I was so scared. I was going, oh, my God, you know. They were the only ones on our block with a Bush Cheney sticker in their window. It was very small. Everybody else had very large boards, and it was almost like they were ashamed. And she called me after she saw it, and she said, I'm bringing my sons to see your play because I have taught them incorrectly.
This has been a conversation with Del Shores. For more information on Del, his website is delshores.net. For info on Season of Shores in Los Angeles, visit seasonofshores.com. And as always, for info on LGBT film, visit prideonscreen.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
There's a rage way down inside me. It's branded my soul, and it leaves me as one of the many, with a hate so hard to control. But I've seen that hate is not the answer. There's a time when we all must decide to step on up with the wisdom and power, and say, children, let's give up the fight. Oh, consider this for a moment or two. Just two, not many colors, and a stained glass window, and no.
The Festival of Shores came and went long ago, but Sordid Lives, the film, can be watched free on the Tubi app, and revivals of Dell's plays are mounted every week around the world, probably at a theater near you. Dell Shores is a brilliant, heartfelt playwright, but I should disclose that I was in the original cast of Southern Baptist Sissies, so I am probably biased. So there's still time for a last word, and tonight, that's Alex from Outcasting Overtime in NYC, who has something to say about bisexuality.
I identify as gay now, but when I first came out to my friends, I identified as bisexual. I did this for two reasons. The first is that, on some level, I had felt attractions to girls before then. It was akin to the crushes that any little kid has before getting wind of what a romantic relationship actually entails. I don't give these crushes much weight now, but I do acknowledge that they were real. They were a part of my experience and development, and I don't want to shrug anything like that off. But my second reason aligns with that stereotype of bisexual people. I wasn't necessarily comfortable identifying as gay straight off the bat. The world of being LGBTQ was alien and scary. Beyond what I had seen on the internet, I had no idea what being gay would mean for my life. Identifying as bisexual was a stepping stone for my later identity as gay. So, I am that stereotype in some way. Eventually, I decided to come out as gay rather than bisexual. The why is important. Examining my sexuality, I see that I am attracted to women on some level. But I am certainly less attracted to women than I am to men. Many people would call me bisexual because of this. Regardless, I choose to identify as gay because I think that a romantic relationship for me with a woman would be unsuccessful and unfulfilling. There are two sides to how we feel attraction, the romantic side and the sexual side. Labels aren't meant to be used to categorize people like scientific names for animals and plants. Even though I might feel some sexual attraction towards women, I'm not interested in dating them. I don't experience romantic attraction towards women. So, because the relationships I'm interested in are with men, I identify as gay. In all, this stereotype of bisexual people makes me conflicted. On one hand, some people might think that my experience validates a largely negative stereotype. On the other hand, this experience is something that I know to be true for me, and was definitely necessary to realize my identity. And I'm inclined to think that this is true. Not everyone who identifies as bisexual will have the same experience as me. Certainly not, because I don't identify that way anymore. Life is far more diverse than we realize. Though labels can instill a sense of community, they can also be trapping. Like all the ways that people identify, stereotypes come with being attached to a group. Not everyone in a specific group is the same. We all have a wide web of beliefs and interests that make us unique and different from other people, even the ones who are most similar to us. And who cares if people change how they identify? Just as our lives undergo all sorts of changes, our attractions can change over time. Because of the nature of our society, everyone is assumed to outwardly identify as straight and cisgender at birth. That doesn't mean that all of us identify that way now, right?
Okay, that's it for tonight. I'm Michael Taylor Gray. Our thanks to IMRU's executive producer Steve Pride and Rainbow Minute producers Judd Proctor and Brian Burns. Find us online at imruradio.org and follow us at Facebook at IMRU Radio. If you are interested in volunteering with IMRU in any capacity, email volunteer@imruradio.org. And a reminder, because we're a global podcast, as well as a show broadcast by the station, you can always hear our weekly show posted to kpfk.org, even during our hiatus from the over-the-air schedule during fund drives. Also catch us at iTunes, Spotify, Breaker, Anchor.fm, CastBox, and Pocket Casts. Good night.
There's nothing wrong with loving who you are, she said, 'cause he made you perfect, babe.
So hold your hand and girl and you go far. Listen to me when I say
I'm beautiful in my way, 'cause God makes no mistakes. I'm on the right track, baby, I was born this way. Don't hide yourself in regret, just love yourself while you're set. I'm on the right track, baby, I was born to be great. I'm beautiful in my way, 'cause God makes no mistakes. I'm on the right track, baby, I was born this way. Don't hide yourself in regret, just love yourself while you're set. I'm on the right track, baby.
baby, 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 baby.